California. It's tape number 439, May the 2nd, 1980, and it's side one. Last week when I did this radio program tape cassette, it was too early to discuss the Iranian situation because the aborted effort to get the hostages in Tehran was just on the headlines and in the news, and there wasn't enough material to put together opinions on the effort, who was behind it. And I have very strong feelings about the government in power there and about what the United States did to Iran over the past 35 years. So I waited until this week, and of course, most of you have given me enough time now to come out with some opinions of the crisis that's taking place in the Middle East. But there are so many areas that we could cover that I'm just going to briefly go over some of the headlines and articles of my favorite stories of the news of the week about Iran and the details of the aborted actions and what followed afterwards. You can catch up in your daily newspapers each day. And if you don't have access to a lot of papers, go to the library and get a cross-section of the information. I mentioned back when the hostages were first taken in November 30th, I called that tape number 417, The Dilemma. A dilemma is defined in the Random House Dictionary as a situation requiring a choice between equally undesirable alternatives. The reason I called it the dilemma of the bearded, funny little holy man and the mighty United States government and the weaponry and technology of the Shah of Iran is that the problem isn't the Shah or who's going to rule Iran. It's a question of the United States bullying countries around for 62 years, ever since Herbert Hoover took congressional money and instead of feeding the poor refugees over in Europe was arming for the next war, for World War II. There's been a facade of peace and peace-loving while we've been aiming to fight and fight the Soviet Union. Napoleon tried twice to get Russia. Germany tried twice. Japan thought they had defeated the Soviet Union in 1905 because they had knocked out their navy and thought that the Soviet Union was a paper tiger that could be divided up between the major nations. And then John Foster and Alan Dulles and the multinational corporations and their lackeys were sure that they could divide the big bear as if he was some kind of a sweet roll that you take for breakfast, you cut up and butter and eat. And so we've turned our butter into guns and have bankrupted almost every country around the world and caused endless pain trying to provoke and get a war against Russia. If we ever got over this psychosis, we could develop all undeveloped nations in to a capitalistic country and share the wealth of each country and trade back and forth instead of knifing each other and let each country enjoy the profit of the resources and the wages that they earn for bringing these resources to the marketplace. That's what it's all about. Back on tape 417, I mentioned two books, The Imperial Shah and The Crown Cannibals. The three books that are being advertised that are out right now, The Rise and Fall of the Shah by Saikal. This was put out by Princeton University Press. The Fall of the Shah by Hoveda, and that should be an interesting book on, it's by a man who talks about the struggle of Khomeini and their long hatred against each other, and he describes the Shah's secret service and the Savak and so forth, and the tragedy, the Greek drama, and that's what this thing is. The Shah is not a man, the Shah of Iran. He represents the best technology, thinking, political action that the United States government thought that they could produce for the last 35 years. And another book, The Fall of the Peacock Throne, The Story of Iran by William Forbes, put out by Harper and Row. These books are available now, and you might write to Tom Davis at Research and see if he has any of the five books on Iran, because, as I say, they're not talking about the Shah. They're talking about American policy after World War II, working with Zahedi and the Nazis that put Hitler into power, the links to the Nazis of Germany, and after World War II, the same Nazis. As a matter of fact, the ambassador of Iran to Washington, D.C., was married to the Shah's daughter. At the time of this aborted invasion of the embassy to get back the hostages. The front pages of the Washington Post and New York Times were having articles that the U.S. was planning a coup in Iran, that they were bringing in troops evidently, and they have acknowledged they have a fifth column there, and I'm sure they were bringing ammunition, and they say there were hundreds of men brought in those airplanes on the desert that night. The ammunition airplane that blew up with so much ammunition on it, it couldn't be used to bring hostages back. You wouldn't load a plane with ammunition for them. They were probably releasing it and sending it out to various people in Iran when it blew up and went into flames, and they had to stop the distribution of the men and the ammunition. There were two articles on the Shah's sister this week. This is the twin sister of the Shah of Iran, Princess Ashraf. Interesting article from the Washington Post and one from the Chicago Tribune. The Washington Post article mentions that she was a courier for Operation Ajax. That was the Central Intelligence operation in 1953 that led to the fall of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh and banished him from the government and put her brother into power, that she was a bag woman for the Central Intelligence Agency in 1953. Operation Ajax is the name for Interpol. That Interpol was the organization formed by Adolf Hitler to keep the list and genealogy of people to be exterminated. It means international police, and they're heavily involved in drug traffic in Marseille and Indochina and in Southeast Asia. That's Operation Ajax, involving Interpol agents, and the Shah's sister at that time was involved not only with Operation Ajax of Iran, but Operation Ajax of the narcotics traffic, putting her brother in power, and I'm sure in exchange for his giving all of his oil, money, and profits to Chase Manhattan and Nelson Rockefeller, David Rockefeller Empire, and big banks, Wall Street banks. In exchange for that, they were allowed to do their dope dealing. The Chicago Tribune has an article on the twin sisters. It says, the Shah's twin. If my people didn't understand, that's too bad for them. The article's by Carol Oppenheimer, Chicago Tribune, and this is the way it begins. They call her Princess 5% because they say she dealt herself into so many lucrative businesses. They accuse her of trafficking in opium and hashish. She had many lovers. She was sinful. She says, I dedicated my whole life for my country, not in the way maybe my brother did, not politically. She wasn't a political branch of the twin family, but she says internationally and socially, and if people didn't understand, that's too bad for them. Picture of her pointing her finger. They called her shrewd, intelligent, and tough. She began her life as the daughter of an army officer and didn't reach royal rank till the age of 6, when her father declared himself the emperor. He made the Pahlavi Foundation, which lasted only 53 years. There's a quotation of her meeting with people like Joseph Stalin and Harry Truman at the height of the Cold War. This article doesn't talk about her being the bag woman for overthrowing Mossadegh and putting her brother in power, but this article describes her work with prime ministers and heads of states traveling around on the foreign scene. It says that she even set up a newspaper lauding and ballyhooing her brother's programs, in quotes, to bring the country into the 20th century. It also says, it talks about in 1976, when she was in the French Riviera and some gunmen shot up her Rolls Royce, her car, in which she was riding, and it was people from the underworld because she was involved with narcotics traffic. She sued Lamont for those statements at the time, and then she was arrested with $2 million worth of heroin in Switzerland. The woman goes on to say that her brother could have stayed in power. She told him to stay in power, but he would have had to kill only 10,000 people. And the Shah of Iran said to her, what shall I do with my hands, the color of blood? How could my son reign with a criminal father? End quote. And then Carol Oppenheimer reminds the readers that in the 10 months preceding the overthrow of the Shah, that his troops killed between 5 and 10,000 demonstrators. And these are the graves that the various priests and United Nations people are invited to see, and the family of the hostages and so forth, the graves of the martyrs. It must be quite impressive to see graves of at least 10,000 people and then the maimed and wounded and the torture instruments. She goes on to say, when they asked her about her wealth, she talks about her property and her Russian emeralds and so forth, and then she says, we were monarchs, we were not poor people. Why don't you ask the American oil cartel how they got their money? And she said, why are you always harassing us? And that's a pretty good question. She's pointing it to the oil cartel. But those are just two articles about this great princess. And when I say her, I mean us, because we put her in and we sold her drugs in this country and around the world and made our streets a place that isn't safe to live because of the distribution of the narcotic traffic that they began to circulate and escalate with organized crime and warriors in the Southeast Asia. Incidentally, Jimmy Carter was in the news media press conference talking about the desecration of the bodies of those eight men, that they were allowed to see the charred remains of those people. I've talked about the Jack Anderson articles where they're barbecuing people alive down in Colonial Dignidad in Chile today on barbecue pits, and there's no outrage from the president at all. He talks about them viewing these dead bodies and bringing them back to the embassy, which was a symbolism or a figure of speech, what they were doing to show that they wanted to come there and kill the guards. And they have now found weapons. They're not laser, but they're similar to that. They were going to use these silencers that boiled the blood of the students, the people that had the hostages, that had taken the hostages. And they were silent weapons so that upstairs and around they wouldn't hear them arriving. But the men below couldn't scream out. Their stomach curdles and the blood boils. And they were going to use these kinds of weapons for the attack at the embassy. Jimmy Carter doesn't talk about the fact that the United States government waged a war in Vietnam that wasn't very sacred or humanitarian. The word humanitarian they use all the time. And then in the coffin, coming home with these people, they cut holes, cavities in the bellies and brought narcotics in from Southeast Asia to the mafia mortuaries. If that isn't a desecration to use a dead soldier as a courier for narcotics to spread all over the United States, I don't know what is. The thing that I really don't like is the one-sided interpretation of history instead of giving the full view. If you're going to tell the truth, tell the whole truth, or don't cast stones at other people. There was a story on the early morning news yesterday. A newspaper in Hong Kong is saying that Ghost the Day had been warned about the planned attack to take his hostages, and that the leak came from the White House. This has been printed in Hong Kong. I believe it, because I believe even inside the Central Intelligence Agency, they fear the Pentagon and the National Security Agency and realize that Jimmy Carter was going to use missiles and weapons and begin a war on the streets of Iran. An automobile and a bus were right on the road where the planes had collided into each other, and there was a village boy, according to a French newspaper, who came across the man in the automobile and thought he was an American, and a soldier followed the car, and then six soldiers continued on the way, and they interviewed this person, and he turned out to be British, and they explained to him, they apologized and said, they told us to catch Americans, it is very important. They weren't looking for any British, as if the great British Empire has given an inch since they gave up a lot of their holdings. Why wouldn't the British be on the road assisting the Americans? And they released this person in the car because they said, oh, you're British, go on. And if he'd been American, they would have held him, but because he was British, they trusted him. I take some credence to the story of the leak that came to warn about the invasion. As I say, Ghost today was meeting with other Arabs, and Iran had threatened to set the entire Persian Gulf afire if we tried a military operation there, and Ghost today would be out of the country and could direct this kind of action from outside the country. Mr. Cyrus Vance gave his resignation on the Wednesday before the action took place and removed himself from Washington, D.C. and went down to Florida, similar to Henry Cabot Lodge leaving Vietnam after carefully planning the removal of Diem and the overthrow of the government there in 1963. He flew to Washington and was on the telephone talking to Diem just before Diem died, actually, and disassociated himself from that. If you watch the national television when Senator Muskie was going to be presented as the new Secretary of State, Brzezinski was to the right of Jimmy Carter, left on the camera, and he was grinning from ear to ear. And it was a very fake grin because he always scowls and looks angry. And I believe that he was faking a smile because they were putting some reins on Brzezinski. People finally caught on and were afraid of Zbigniew Brzezinski, and that smile that he had, if you go or believe in body talk, was very revealing. The appointment of Muskie was made to calm the situation down And I'm sure that Jimmy Carter's going to Texas and seeing five charred bodies is more impressive than sending a plane to drop 100,000 people with atomic weaponry like Nagasaki or Hiroshima. If Harry Truman had gone before and seen radiation burns, I think he would have thought more about it. I think that Carter got a sight of the what he was doing or what he was responsible for when he saw these individuals, and then went home and appointed Senator Muskie to help take care of situations in Washington. Philip Taubman in the New York Times had a story, Military Options Still Open, and Secretary of State Cyrus Vance resigning in protest. Then another headline that same day for the Washington Bureau of the San Jose Mercury, Brzezinski grabs the foreign policy reins. That Brzezinski's the man who made the decision to declare the Persian Gulf of vital interest to the United States, to be defended with force. He was a proponent of the MX missile. He fought to shelve the SALT II treaty, and that Mr. Vance was disheartened by the power, and by his resigning, Brzezinski grabbed the reins. The Soviet Union replied by responding to the Muskie nomination in saying, in quote, it lends a certain respectability to U.S. foreign policy. He was referring to Brzezinski, according to the Associated Press, who they called an extreme anti-Soviet adventurist, and they predicted that Muskie's appointment would calm public opinion in the United States among the Western allies, alarmed by the influence of people like Brzezinski. Richard Nixon used the occasion to urge a 20% increase in American military expenditure, and Henry Kissinger had an interview, the U.S. patience is not endless. The morning that Senator Muskie was appointed as Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger was on either Good Morning America or the Today Show, and he absolutely looked dejected, as if his foreign policies were going out the window, and he referred to the fact that the French are meeting with the Soviet Union and that our allies, he can't understand why they're not behind us. And he looked as if he was in total confusion about what was going on in the world. And I realize now that the announcement a few hours later that Senator Muskie was to be Secretary of State came as a total shock to Henry Kissinger and wounded deeply probably Brzezinski because of the tight control they've had over foreign policy all these years. And as I've said many times, the foreign policy decisions were taken away from Congress and put in the National Security Council, set up by Reinhard Gehlen, chief of Hitler's intelligence, and run these years by Brzezinski and Kissinger, who I believe are both Nazis that have determined to ruin the United States and carry on their suicidal policies. But by making Muskie the Secretary of State, he's a man that's respected in the Congress, and he may be able to call attention to Brzezinski and some of the things that are going on and be a stable influence where the people of the United States begin to be considered, and he can represent the people of the United States. The terminology of the Pentagon is just amazing. They refer to affairs as an expeditious extraction, which means we had to leave fast because we bumped into each other and our equipment didn't work. They call aborted missions just total failures, again, of morale, equipment, and so forth. Strategic mistakes, blundering. The airplanes don't work. The helicopters don't work. The ammunition has to be knocked into by another helicopter. There's sand in the equipment. They had to hose the equipment down before it ever left the ships. They left their spy information inside, and they didn't anticipate dust sandstorms. I don't know how they could miss that when they didn't put the catches over the traps that hold the sand out of the helicopters. The pilots had vertigo and dizziness and couldn't handle the operation. Did Carter mislead? The headlines say they don't say, did Carter lie to the people because he told us there weren't any planned military operations and he actually had missiles and weapons. He had the weapons of the kind that you aim at the students holding the embassy, and their intestines dissolve and boil. It makes the blood boil. Some of these were found on the helicopters that were left behind, and this would prevent the people upstairs from hearing them scream. They wouldn't scream. You just zap them like a machine gun, but it just goes into their system and boils the blood, and they can't even scream out. It silences and can be fatal at the same time and leaves these people reduced, on the ground. I believe that the importance of testing helicopters, silent helicopters, and animal mutilations that have gone on, particularly out of Colorado where the Air Force is, and these spaceships that resemble flying saucers, and also the actual helicopters, have been testing animal mutilations, cutting them up, and directing tranquilizer guns and surgical procedures to frighten the farmers and so forth, and not leave a trace of who's there. They can see off the ground and fly and cut up, kill, and depart without being detected. And I think this kind of practice exercise that's been going on in New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, and so forth, the huge files I have on animal mutilations and Army involvement and the CIA with their tranquilizer weapons and systems is very useful applied to a situation like an embassy where they could get in quietly and kill. It'd be similar to taking the animal and killing. And when I read about the tranquilizers and the weapons, it reminded me of all the work that I've accumulated on the animal mutilations and the belief of the farmers and investigators now that it is linked to the military. The Iranian government has warned about the plan to set fire to the Persian Gulf. We have 38 or more battleships in that tiny area, and if the United States government provokes a situation over there, the oil would be cut off, and we'd have another Pearl Harbor where the chance for peace wouldn't exist because we'd be forced at that time to go to war. Whether you have Muskie or McGovern or any peace dove, no matter who it is, you would still be forced to go to war if all the oil is cut off from the United States. Los Angeles Times has an article this week, NATO allies have only enough bullets and bombs to fight 3 or 4 weeks. Well, that's good. They shouldn't be so strong about boycotting the Olympic Games or making the threat that they would have atomic missiles on each of their 7 countries aimed at the Soviet Union. If they only have enough bullets for 3 to 4 weeks, they must expect to use nothing but atomic bombs and not even use the traditional warfare. I read that after this confrontation this last week in Iran, that the United States government has asked for $2 billion more for germ warfare, and I don't think they intend to do street-to-street fighting very much, except for the wipe-up, and that's where we'll lose that battle. We'll use gas and germ warfare and atomic warfare. And I don't think the supply of NATO for bullets for 3 to 4 weeks would hardly cover what they're going to need if they keep egging on the Soviet Union. There's an article published also. This is the Washington Post, Iranian Fifth Column waited for rescuers. Now, why would they publish that? Because people are still living there. The newspaper yesterday said the parts of the plane, instead of being destroyed, remained, and inside were the list, possible list, of Iranians that were planted there to serve the United States counterintelligence troops in Iran. And they fear for their life because the names are there. So on the one hand, Washington Post has a story that we do have this fifth column behind the lines, and now the Iranian government has a possible list of those people. So somebody is really backing off from this confrontation and seeming to be synchronized in what looks like a series of blunders, but there couldn't be that many. Or maybe there could. The Soviet Union article in the New York Times this last week titled, "No More Stunts," the Soviet warned. Another one, counter-terrorist team exists but doesn't give interviews. Now, this is the Knight News Service, and this is from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And the interesting point is how the system works. They talk about 300 specially trained military men. Everyone is a trained killer. They're from Fort Bragg, South Carolina, and when they go in there, they lose all identification. They don't wear military uniforms. They lose sight of their old friends. They get caught in training and so forth. It goes into the case of Charles Beckwith, who lost. He's listed in the phone directory but has no phone. He was the man in charge of this operation over in Iran. And officially, these people don't exist. The records are gone. There's no indication of where they are. And they work in matters such as urban terrorism and so forth, and set up, they're similar to the SWAT teams that the police have. But very often a person like Frank Turple or George Kokola can be arrested and have the silencers, the weapons, the trained assassination teams, and the media says, we don't know them. They're not stationed at Fort Bragg. They're not at Fort Ord. They're not at this military base or that. And when these operations come down, then you learn that they lose all identity and they lose their friends. One of the important things to remember in an article like this from the Knight Service was, it says they lose track in sight of their old friends, and they get caught in rigorous training. When Lee Harvey Oswald was described as the man who killed John Kennedy, and it was convenient for the news media to say he killed him, one of the modes was he had no friends and didn't see people. Lee Harvey Oswald was seeing people all the time, but they were all military defense industry people and members of these assassination killer teams, and he may have agreed to be the fall guy and was later framed and killed, or his double was framed and killed, and he was allowed to leave the country. But when a person is caught, they say, oh, he's a loner, he had no friends. But part of the training is to disassociate yourself from these people, lose your identity, separate from your friends. And I wrote in one of my early articles that there's a difference between being a loner and being alone. You can be a loner because you don't like anybody, don't want anybody around you, but you can be alone because you were ordered to be alone. And that's a very good distinction. And the deniability of an operation is to, or disavowal is to say, we don't know who they are, we don't know where they were, we don't know where they came from. But part of the operation is to lose the identity before they're used, so the event they're caught, they're not linked to the very agents that are undermining this country. We're ashamed of them. A normal soldier wears an ID around him with his name and identification, but the silent soldiers that are overthrowing the world don't have these badges of identification, and so that we can't finger the intelligence community as really being the operators of overthrowing countries and killing heads of state. Of course, there's another headline this week, Iran turns to Russia for trade. We're going to force many countries to turn to Russia where they wouldn't be pro-Soviet and didn't want to be in the first place. Another article in the Washington Post, logic points to military move by the United States. Carter was moved, it says, the logic points to Carter's choice against Iran. There was no logic in this at all. There was also another article in the newspaper, should Carter have apologized to Iran? This was by Coleman McCarthy, a Washington Post columnist. Mrs. Langman, Penny Langman, the wife of Bruce Langman, is now a hostage in the embassy, a foreign servant agent of 20 years. His wife was on radio this week for an hour interview, and the way she spoke and the mentality that she has typifies the problem with our State Department and what is going on in the world today. She said she preferred that her husband die over there or be killed rather than the United States government apologize to Iran. She made the statement that the diplomats are the peacemakers and mobocracy would rule if we didn't protect the diplomats. The diplomats are the wheelers and dealers for the corporations, and when they wheel and deal too many times, the mob will take over. She is wrong. The mob will take over in every country if we rely on the diplomats. She said five of her friends in the diplomatic service, their friends have been killed in the last few years. She doesn't talk about the millions of displaced people, or take Cambodia alone now, or Chile and Argentina, Brazil, or Haiti, or what's going on in Cuba. The millions, millions of people dying today because the diplomats made the arrangements that did that to the country. The mob will not stand it anywhere very long, and there's going to be changes in every country. Iran is just a symbol because it was that, and Chile and the Greek military junta that was eventually overthrown are symbols of the most blatant use of power and force and greed for money. And it affects us the most because of the oil price increase that Kissinger and the Shah and David Rockefeller put in. Copper may increase in Chile and our phone rates or wires may go up, but nothing affects us as much as the oil profits. So the problem of American exploitation is best epitomized in Iran, and the use of the Savak and the military police, the greed, the accumulated wealth, the wealth in the hands of a few, the use of Americans and the greed of the people they put in, and the combination of narcotics, mob, and oil, CIA epitomizes American State Department diplomacy for the last years, and that's why Iran is such an important case. But mobocracy is sure to rule the streets of America soon, just as it is in Iran now, and when the war comes home, you'll understand it a little bit better. The first accounts of the Iranian crisis said that when the powers that be in Washington met, they went up to the cabinet room upstairs. They couldn't go to the situation room, which is the crisis room, because that was occupied with the refugee crisis in Cuba, so they had to use the cabinet room. So So I can see a time soon when the entire White House, every room is turned to a different part of the world, the Haiti room, the Chile room, the Brazil room, the American riot room, and maybe turn every room into a warfare place and have a conference there and go from room to room to see what we could put down and cover up and how we cover our tracks. When the Situation Room is occupied, then they use the Cabinet Room for the Iranian crisis. On the other side of this tape, I'll do a little more about Iran and then some other important matters.